this week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
We have to ask ourselves the question, why is this journalist, why is this Black activist not free?
The fact that a sitting judge has spoken out in this case is tremendous. It speaks to the validity of the new exculpatory evidence in this case.
Judge Lucretia Clemens recently gave prosecutors and the defense 60 days to review files never seen before by Mumia Abdul-Jamal's legal team.
When we first put this in solitary confinement, you could only have like two or three pair of underwear and a t-shirt. And, you know, you couldn't have books or radios. Those things were gained later as a result of a resistance and organizing and hunger strikes and stuff like it that we won the right to, you know, change.
A salute to former political prisoner and freedom fighter Albert Woodfox, who transitioned this year. His 2019 memoir was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Solitary, Unbroken by Four Decades in Solitary Confinement, My Story of Transformation and Hope.
This is our duty, to know our past and honor it, to engage our present and improve it, and to imagine a whole new future and forge it.
And Molly Bell, Straight Outta Compton, on the celebration of Kwanzaa. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Amy Goodman, host and producer of Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report, spoke with Professor Johanna Fernandez, associate professor of history at City University of New York's Baroque College, one of the coordinators of the campaign to bring Mumia home. Mumia Abdul-Jamal is a renowned journalist, activist, and author of several books, including Live from Death Row. He's been in prison for over 40 years, spending most of his sentence on death row. After numerous appeals, the sentence was overturned by a federal court in 2011, and the prosecution agreed to life imprisonment without parole. However, Judge Lucretia Clemens recently gave prosecutors and the defense 60 days to review files never seen before by Mumia's legal team. The judge may rule on Mumia Abdul-Jamal's request for a new trial. For more on Mumia Abdul-Jamal's case, here's Amy Goodman and Professor Johanna Fernandez.
So why don't you talk about the scene in the courtroom, the issue of bribery, if you could explain that. And once again, the judge himself in the original trial, Judge Szabo, referring to Mumia Abdul-Jamal with the N-word.
That letter, handwritten by Robert Chobert, is really the smoking gun, if you will, in this case. It's exculpatory evidence. At this hearing, the prosecutor argued somehow that it is pro forma, it is customary to give witnesses money. But our attorneys corrected the record. They said, well, yes, you give witnesses money for missed work and for transportation. However, Robert Chobert was driven to work by police nightly. He was a cab driver. And he was held in a hotel, and all of his expenses were paid. And he was cared for by the police during the trial. So what money exactly was he being compensated for? This is bribery. He would have said in the letter, I was promised compensation for travel, but that could not have been the case. Another thing that was raised in the hearing by our attorneys is the significance of circumstantial evidence and inference. This was a man who was driving with two DWIs and who was driving without a license. He said that he was parked directly behind the police car, the car of Officer Faulkner, who was killed that night. But photographs show that he was not where he said he was. And a person who's driving with two DWIs and a driver's license that's been canceled is not going to want to park anywhere near a police officer's car. So the record suggests that Robert Chobert was bribed for fingering Mumia.
And the judge, Judge Szabo, what he said, reportedly overheard by the stenographer in the original trial?
Terry Moore Carter was a stenographer at the time, working with a different judge. And her judge used the same courtroom that the lead judge in this case, Albert Szabo, used. And this was during a shift of cases. And Terry Moore Carter, the white stenographer, overheard the major judge in this case, Albert Szabo, say, quote, "I'm going to help them fry the N-word," referring to how he was going to instruct the jury in this case. The amicus brief that was filed by the working group of experts of people of African descent said that it is the responsibility of the state to remediate decades, centuries of racism, that there was no time bar on this, and that it is the responsibility of this court to right this wrong. The only way to right this wrong is to release a man who was wrongfully on death row for 28 and a half years. A federal judge ruled that his death sentence was obtained unconstitutionally in 2010, and he was released to serve a life in prison without parole. You'd think that after 28 and a half years of wrongful sentence on death row, you'd get out of prison.
And can you tell me more about Cynthia White? She was another witness. And what apparently is in these boxes that were found in the DA's office, and the significance of the fact they were found, what, in 2019?
So they were found in January 2019, and what we see is a string of documents wherein the lead prosecutor in the case, Joe McGill, is tracking what is happening to Cynthia White's other cases. She was a sex worker and had over 36 violations pending against her. So she was facing upwards of 20 years in prison, and he was consulting with other prosecutors, ensuring that before they made any decision in Cynthia White's case, they consulted with him. So there was clearly some kind of bargain made between Cynthia White and the prosecutor, Joe McGill, that if she fingered Mumia, she would get off and would not have to serve time in prison.
I wanted to go to Judge Wendell Griffin. We spoke to him last week. He's a Division V judge of the Sixth Circuit in Arkansas. He spent more than 10 years as a judge in the State Court of Appeals. He's retiring at the end of this year after almost a quarter of a century on the bench. This is what he had to say about why he's become a prominent voice, another trial judge, just like the trial judge in Philadelphia. But he's in Little Rock. Why he's become a prominent voice for a new trial and the release of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We have to ask ourselves the question, why is this journalist, why is this black activist not free? And why is it so hard for a judge to say, hey, we've got the law that requires him to be free. I'm going to follow the law and declare him free. And if the Commonwealth wants to retry him, they can do so. If the Commonwealth decides we can't retry him because the evidence is no longer there, people have passed away, witnesses have forgotten information, then that is not Mumia's fault. That is the fault of prosecutors, and Mumia should not be imprisoned because, A, he had a pretense of a trial in the first place, and B, because for some reasons, bloodlust or the desire to keep a black activist journalist in prison means that we don't want to do what's right.
Again, that is sitting Arkansas trial judge Wendell Griffin speaking to us from Little Rock, Arkansas. The significance of this judge speaking out, and then I want to go back to the beginning before we end, and what happened on Friday, what you expected to happen, what the judge had said would happen on Friday, but then what did happen?
Well, she had promised on October 26th that she would make a decision in this case on December 16th. And in fact, she issued an intent to dismiss opinion on October 26th and said, we will make a final decision on December 16th because this case has gone on for too long. But the facts of this case, she now understands, merit adjudication. And the prosecutor in this case said over and over again, these issues have been litigated. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court litigated this issue. Why are you bringing this up now? What the prosecution fails to understand is that new evidence has emerged that that office has hidden for 41 years. That is the reason why these previous courts were unable to grant Mumia relief, not to mention the fact that the judges in this case have historically been funded by the Fraternal Order of Police, the same organization that has attempted to keep Mumia behind bars and the same organization that attempted to execute him and make sure that he was executed when he was on death row. The fact that a sitting judge has spoken out in this case is tremendous. It speaks to the validity of the new exculpatory evidence in this case.
That was Amy Goodman, host and producer of Democracy Now!, and Professor Johanna Fernandez, executive producer and writer of the film Justice on Trial, The Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and the editor of Writing on the Wall, Selected Prison Writings of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Visit prisonradio.org for more information. Terry Lynn Carrington in Social Science, Trapped in the American Dream. Freedom has come for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur. He's a 72-year-old grandfather, respected healer and activist, and stepfather of the late iconic hip-hop artist Tupac Shakur. He was granted parole at a hearing on October 12th by the U.S. Parole Commission and released on December 16th. Dr. Mutulu Shakur is one of thousands of incarcerated elders in federal and state prison who had been denied parole repeatedly for over a decade after completing his minimum sentence. Adam Carpinelli, host and producer of Prison Pipeline at Pacifica affiliate KBOO, and Bob Lederer, longtime activist and host of Out FM, WBAI in New York, had a conversation about the case of former political prisoner Dr. Mutulu Shakur.
When I got active in the New York anti-imperialist movement in the 70s, the project that Dr. Shakur had been so instrumental to, which was called Lincoln Detox, Lincoln being the name of a hospital in the South Bronx serving mainly low-income Black and Latino people, Latinx people who lived there. And so I was quickly told about the cutting-edge nature of that institution that had come out of the radical groups of the 60s, the Young Lords, which is a Puerto Rican independence organization, the Black Panthers, white radical doctors and med students, and others. And what Dr. Shakur had brought to that was acupuncture. And so as I had already on my own come to discover the power of acupuncture, I actually did take a trip up to Lincoln Detox and met Dr. Shakur before it was brutally shut down by the then mayor of the city in 1978. And then because he traveled in the same political circles that I did through his work with the National Black Human Rights Coalition and the National Task Force on COINTELPRO litigation and research, and COINTELPRO was the FBI's decades-long program to attack and dismantle the radical left, particularly the Black Liberation Movement. So our paths kept crossing on several occasions. And of course, then he found himself in federal prison after years of being targeted by COINTELPRO itself. Then he was in prison for a 60-year sentence for a conspiracy and bank robbery and related charges. And so I've tried to do what I can to support the many, many efforts to bring him to freedom. First, on parole, he was denied 9 times by the Federal Parole Commission until finally on the brink of death, which he is now, sadly, he was finally granted parole. He had been denied parole 9 times. And this is despite meeting every criterion that the Parole Commission sets for being granted parole, simply out of vindictiveness because he was political enemy number one and could not be allowed to see the light of day. And so finally, as he got one life-threatening illness after another, including COVID, and including diabetes, hypertension, glaucoma, ultimately, he got diagnosed about 3 years ago with stage 4 bone marrow cancer. And at this point, the Bureau of Prisons doctor has, in May of this year, diagnosed his estimated prognosis. In other words, the time he probably could survive was 6 more months. Well, that's now. 6 months are now. Dr. Shakur has been one of the many voices, not only asking people to work to free him from his unjust incarceration, but also what at times had been up to 100 other activists from the Black Liberation Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Chicano Freedom Movement, the Native American and Indigenous movements, and white people in solidarity with people of color and with international freedom movements. And so out of that movement has come the Spirit of Mandela Coalition, which organized about 3 years ago and held a tribunal last year, an international tribunal with human rights experts from around the world to look at definitely the issue of U.S. political prisoners, but also the related struggles that Black, Indigenous, and other people of color have had to face in this country, specifically police violence, mass incarceration, environmental racism, and health racism. And they came out with a verdict finding the U.S. government guilty of genocide. So Dr. Shakur's case was talked about in that proceeding among many, and he's been one of the people really pointing the way for more than 40 years to the need to look at U.S. policy in a human rights framework. And one of the proposals that he's made, I think it was about 25 years ago, and it's actually been picked up by some mainstream groups like the NAACP, at least in the past, is for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And this would be a body of legislative and clergy and civic leaders, as well as activists, that would look at the violations of human rights committed by the U.S. government, particularly in the late 60s and early 70s, including, as I mentioned before, this COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI, and would figure out, well, first of all, would expose the full depth of the outrageous activities of the U.S. government, but also figure out remedies and ways to bring healing and repair to those who've been victimized by those policies. So Dr. Shakur, besides being a very dedicated activist, has also been a very innovative thinker. And his thinking has helped guide a lot of other activists in coming up with new strategies to break through some of the problems that we all are struggling against. So there's a huge need for funds. So I would encourage people to go to the website MutuluShakur.com, and I'll spell that MUTULU, and then Shakur, SHAKUR.com, MutuluShakur.com. And there's a button on the right for donating to his medical and other support needs. And it would be just so appreciative if people can be generous, because after all he's given to so many movements for so many decades, we really should give back to him so that he can live the longest possible time that he can and continue to give his gifts to the community.
That was longtime activist Bob Lederer, co-founder of the Anti-Racist, Anti-Imperialist Resistance in Brooklyn Collective, and a member of the Spirit of Mandela Coalition. Bob Lederer is the co-host of the weekly QueerOutFM.org on Pacifica, WBAI Radio in New York. Dr. Mutulu Shakur was released on December 16th, 2022.
I apologize for being black. For all I am plus all I lack. Please, sir, please, ma'am, give me some slack, because I apologize. I apologize for being poor, for being sick and tired and so. Since I ain't slick, don't know the scope, I do apologize. I apologize because I bear resemblance most black people share. Thick lips, flat nose, and nappy hair. Yes, I apologize. I apologize for how I look, for all the lows and blows I took. On those, Lord knows I'd close the book as I apologize. I apologize for all I gave, for letting you make me your slave and go into my early grave. Yes, I apologize. I apologize for being caught, for being sold, for being bought, while being told I count for naught. Yeah, I apologize. I apologize for all I've done, for all my toil out in the sun. Don't want to spoil your righteous fun, so I apologize. I apologize and curse my kind for being fooled, for being blind, for being ruled and in your band. Yes, I apologize. I apologize and curse my fate for being slow, for being late, because I know it's me you hate. Why not apologize? I apologize and tip my hat, because you so rich and free and fat. Son of a bitch, that's where it's at. And I apologize.
Oscar Brown Jr. live. I apologize. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Black Panther Party member Albert Woodfox was an activist and author who was caged in solitary confinement for 44 years in a Louisiana state prison, formerly known as Angola, on armed robbery charges in 1965. He was wrongfully convicted of the 1972 murder of a prison guard, along with the late Herman Wallace. Wallace and Woodfox, along with Robert King, became the Angola Three political prisoners. The prison was located on the site of a former plantation called Angola, after the African country from which most of the plantation's enslaved people had been captured. According to The Guardian, Woodfox's conviction was overturned multiple times throughout his solitary confinement. The warden of Angola admitted under oath in a legal deposition that they were being held in CCR, closed cell restricted, where prisoners were locked up alone for at least 23 hours a day because of their, quote, pantherism. Albert Woodfox gained his freedom on his 69th birthday in 2016 after a plea deal to lesser charges. He always maintained his innocence. He spent the next 6 years educating the public in the U.S. and internationally regarding the horrors of the criminal justice system and advocating against solitary confinement. Woodfox said the strength and determination of his beloved mother, Miss Ruby Mabel Hamlin, instilled in him to keep going. Here's veteran journalist and host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, along with Albert Woodfox.
When you got out of jail, the first thing you did was go to your mother's grave.
Yes.
When did she die?
She died in 94, December.
More than 20 years before you got out.
Yeah, in the African-American household, it is always coming to terms with the lost one of someone in the family when you can say that final goodbye. When you can say from your heart and your soul, I love you and I'll miss you, but I'll never forget you. And so I was denied that right. I was denied the right to go to my mom's wake or funeral and say that final goodbye. So I had to live with that burden, you know, until the day I was released from prison. And the same thing with my sister, you know, when I lost my sister in 2002, both to cancer. The lawyers had made arrangements for me to attend the funeral. But on the day that the sheriffs from Orleans Parish come to pick me up, Warden Kane canceled everything. Now, this is a man who projected the image of being a Christian and believing in family and everything. But yet, because of my political belief, because they couldn't break me, because I would never renounce the Black Panther Party, as they demanded as a turn from being released from solitary confinement, I guess he saw another opportunity to inflict pain upon me. And so I was denied the right to, you know, say goodbye to my sister. And on the day I was released, you know, we went straight to the graveyard, and the graveyard was closed because there had been a two-hour delay in releasing me. I wanted to climb over the fence, and my brother was like, no, no, no. You know, we're not having that. You just got out of prison. We're not going to, you know, give these people. So we left with a deep heart, and we went and said goodbye to my sister and my brother-in-law, who was also a childhood friend. And the next day, with an abundance of flowers, we went. And I was finally able to lift that burden that I had carried for so long.
I wanted actually to go to your brother, who you remain close to, Michael Mabel.
Yes.
You remain close to him in prison. I wanted to go to your brother, Michael Mabel, who you remain close to in prison and who was there to greet you when you got out in 2016. When you joined us days later on Democracy Now!, he was there, too.
Yes.
And he described for us how those first days after getting out, you visited your mother's grave.
It was closure for him. I periodically always visit my mother's grave. My mother took her last breath with me holding her hands, and I would always let him know how she went and how much, you know, she continues to look down and know that he's going to struggle for the right thing in this world. And, you know, him and King and Hooks have always given me strength to go against the world. And, you know, no matter what happens, it's that if you continue to hope and strength and you fight for a right cause, then you can do anything you want.
So that's Michael, your brother. That was just a few days after you got out. So I want to go back to your time in prison. It's amazing to me that rather than just leaving it all behind, I mean, it already consumed so many decades of your life. You are spending your life free talking about what's happening inside. I think, to say the least, it's impossible for anyone who hasn't gone through this to understand what it means to live in a 6-by-9-foot cell for more than 4 decades. How did you maintain your sanity? Describe for us, being in that cell, what it felt like.
Actually, the measurements of the cell are 6 feet wide, 9 feet long. But there is actually less space available because you have two bunks attached to the wall that takes up half of the cell. And you have a toilet bowl, face bowl combination on the back wall. And you have an iron table with a bench on the thing. So you have a very narrow pathway in which you can move back and forth in the cell. When you're first put in solitary confinement, you go through this period where you want to scream, you know, because, you know, nothing you can do to fight this. In hindsight, I would say it was probably the early stages of claustrophobic. Depending on the individual, as time goes on, you learn to control your emotions, your feeling of being smothered and being confined. And so, you know, but then, you know, we first put this in solitary confinement. You could only have like 2 or 3 pair of underwear and a T-shirt, and, you know, you couldn't have books or radios. Those things were gained later as a result of a resistance and organizing and hunger strikes and stuff like it, that we wanted the right to, you know, change.
What access did you have to reading material, to books?
At that time, only a Bible. They had a Bible in each cell. But the thing was that so many other prisoners had gained respect for what we were trying to do, that, you know, they would actually take a chance and sneak us like newspapers and novels and books like it there. But as I said, over the decades, as a result of a resistance and court cases, filing cases in the court, we, you know, slowly began to expand what solitary confinement looked like.
That was the voice of Black Panther Party member and former political prisoner, an advocate against solitary confinement, Albert Woodfox. He made his transition August 4th, 2022, from coronavirus complications, according to his lawyers. Woodfox was an organizer and educator who provided education for anyone willing to learn while in prison. Find out more about Albert Woodfox. Check out his 2019 memoir, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, Solitary Unbroken, by 4 decades in solitary confinement, My Story of Transformation and Hope.
Okay. Got your shea butter?
Check.
All right. How about your dashiki?
You know it, bro.
And your Hotep manual. Did you bring that?
You know what, King?
Aw, man.
It's Kwanzaa. What you gonna do? Spinning with my family, chill with the crew. We gon' share gifts, you don't have to spend loot. We celebrate culture, our African roots. This Kwanzaa, what you gon' do? Spinning with my family, chill with the crew. We gon' share gifts, you don't have to spend loot. We celebrate culture, our African
Check.
Roots.
On December 26th, goodbye Saint Nick. I light a black candle, look, ooh, it's lit. First day of Kwanzaa, Umoja means unity. Ain't messing with my clique, melanated, check the drip.
Self-determination is the mantra. Constant elevation. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. 2022 marks the 56th annual celebration of Kwanzaa. The theme is Kwanzaa, Culture and the Practice of Freedom, a message and model for our times. Fahima Sek of WPFW and Molly Bell, activist straight out of Compton, tells us more.
Molly Bell, thank you for joining us here at Pacifica Radio.
Reparations in memory of our ancestors, and Abari Ghani to you, Sister Fahima. Abari Ghani, for those who don't, and me, what's the grand news? What is the good news? And thank you, Radio Pacifica, for allowing me to talk about Kwanzaa. First of all, let's just begin from the beginning. Kwanzaa is a week-long African-American festival, December the 26th to January the 1st, that concludes 1 year and begins another year. The festival comes from the East African Swahili phrase, Marunde ya Kwanzaa, which means first fruits of the harvest, and was established in 1966 by Dr. Saba Malana Karinga. And Saba means moral teacher, a leading theorist of African-American history and culture. A cultural celebration, Kwanzaa has no ties to specific religious beliefs or practice. It can, however, be enhanced by individual faith practices and tradition central to the celebration of the Nguza Saba, or the 7 principles of Kwanzaa. Let's begin with Nguza Saba are 7 social and spiritual principles for everyday living developed by Dr. Milana Gringa. These principles deal with the way we relate to one another and the development of positive self and cultural images. That is awesome. Let's begin with the first one. The first principle is umoja. And umoja, and I'm doing it in this order, umoja is to strive to for and maintain unity in the family. Umoja, that is the principle of unity. The second principle is kujichagulia, which means self-determination, to define ourselves.
And that actually is my birthday. I'm born on the second day of Kwanzaa, kujichagulia, and actually self-determination pretty much describes my personality.
That is great. A lot of people can't say that. So it is to determine ourselves, to name ourselves, and create for ourselves and speak for ourselves. And I have to agree with you, that is you. The third principle is ujima, which means collective work and responsibility. It means to build and maintain our community together and to make our brothers and sisters' problems our problems and to solve them together. The fourth principle is ujamaa. Ujamaa means cooperative economics. Boy, we need that. To build and maintain our own stores, shops, and other businesses, and to profit from them together. The fifth principle is NIA, which means purpose. And I like those letters, N-I-A. I always say it means necessary I am. And it means to make our collective vocations the building and developing of our community in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness. The sixth principle is kaumba, which means creativity, to do always as much as we can in the way that we can in order to leave our community more beautiful and beneficial than when we inherit it. And the seventh principle is imani, which means faith. Faith to believe with all our hearts in our parents, our teachers, our leaders, and our people, and the righteousness and victory of the struggle. Now, when you're celebrating Kwanzaa, I want you to use some of these symbols. One is a mikaka, which is the mat. You put everything on a mat. The kanara is the candle holder, and you're going to put seven candles in them. In the middle of the candle is always the black candle. And that's for what? Unity. That stands for our people. And then on the right, looking at it, on the right side of it is the green candle. You'll have three. And on the left side of it, looking at it, you'll have red. And those are the seven principles. And each day you take the black candle and light the candle for the very next day. Always light them with the people. The people has to do everything. And then we also have food like the ear of corn, kiumba, you know, which is the unity cup. On the first day, we drink from a cup. That's a unity cup. And we all take a little sip from that same cup. And that's very important. And of course, there's the mazo, which is fruits and vegetables. And then there's zawaidi, which are gifts. The gifts that are given to us by our family and friends, they're not toys. They are things that will enhance us, like books to read. I guess now that we're in the 21st century, videos that are positive. Give them things that are positive. We're not looking for bikes and skates like that. Those are the ones that they want. Now, Kwanzaa, according to Dr. Kuringa, who is the creator of it, he says that our African culture is the tradition, is the heart and soul of a principle called Kawaida. Let me just share with you the principle of Kawaida. Kawaida is, this is our duty, to know our past and honor it, to engage our present and improve it, and to imagine, and some of you have great imaginations, and to imagine a whole new future and forge it. That word forge is not a word I use a lot, but to forge it in the most ethical, effective, and expansive ways. Forging our future in righteous, relentless struggle And then we have to remember, some people says, well, we can't do all of that. That's kind of hard. Well, Nelson Mandela said, it always seems impossible until it is done. Those are the principles. And Dr. Karinga asked us just to remember that culture is our totality of sensitivity and celebration. And that includes religion, history, social organizations, economic, politically, shared wealth, shared good of power, power to bring good into the moral world for which we stand. So this is just a short emphasis on Kwanzaa and what it's all about. And I asked you to celebrate it. And when you end Kwanzaa, we always say Harambe, which means pull together. Abarigani is what's the good news. And we always end everything, let's pull together. And I close by saying the way I close out here, all you prayer warriors out there, you know what you've got to do. You've got to keep fasting and praying because the struggle continues, but always to God be the glory. Thank you, Sister Fahima. Thank you, Pacifica Radio. And you keep on Pacifica Radio doing the great things that you are doing.
Well, Molly, I just want to give people the website for the US organization, www.us-organization.org. If you want to get more information about Kwanzaa and the organization that founded it and the 56th annual Kwanzaa celebration, please log on to that website. Thank you so much, Molly Bell. I'm Fahima Seck for Pacifica Radio, COVID, Race, and Democracy. Thank you.
Asante sana.
We thank Fahima Seck of WPFW and co-producer of this Kwanzaa program, and Miss Molly Bell, activist straight out of Compton and organizer for this segment.
A creator.
This Kwanzaa, what you gonna do? Spending with my family, chill with the crew. With the crew. We gon' share gifts, you don't have to spend loot. We celebrate culture, our African roots. This Kwanzaa, what you gonna do? Spending with my family, chill with the crew. We gon' share gifts, you don't have to spend loot. We celebrate culture, our African roots.
This Kwanzaa featuring Pierce Freelon, Happy Kwanzaa Song for Kids and Families. Kwanzaa is an African-American cultural tradition that is celebrated globally. Bukenyere of the National Association of Kawaita Organizations reflects on the history and significance of Kwanzaa.
Well, I'm an advocate of Kawaita. I was reading Dr. Marlana Karenga, was a magazine, it was called Black Scholar. And I read some of his articles, and what happened was I found out that he was saying what I was thinking, and the articulation of it was the way I wish I could talk. At a African history scholars meeting in Chicago, I got to see him, and I was more enthralled. When I got back to New York, some of us who knew each other as activists had meetings over a period of 2 years, and then out of that came the National Association of Kawaita Organizations in different parts that would study Kawaita, the philosophy, which means Kawaita being a synthesis word, simply meaning the best of African tradition and reasoning. We formulated a group since 1988. We've been together. We've become clearer on different issues that we all supported and would give a national outreach to. There, in 1966, Dr. Karenga created Kwanzaa, and it has grown steadily. And it's grown nationally and internationally as a practice to observe, one, that which would bring us together and a spirit in which we could celebrate our Africanness. The fact that there was a need to address our culture, how that would relate to how we deal with the world and our historic issues with our oppression.
Talk to us about some of the activities you guys have been engaged in over the years.
What we've done is we brought in scholars, we brought in medical people to discuss issues such as the donation of your organs upon death, medical insurance, and things like that. We do programs that cover the political spectrum, whether that's international or national, to bring more clarity and support, a way of defining how we see things philosophically. And one of the reasons is people may challenge what you're thinking. You begin to strengthen yourself by knowing why you practice a certain way of life, because nobody challenges why people support Hanukkah or Cinco de Mayo. Nobody challenges those practices naturally from the oppressor or those that embrace that thinking. They want you to explain why you would be so focused on keeping your identity, seeking out the knowledge of yourself from a lost memory.
Again, when they argue why Kwanzaa over all the others, and I heard some scholars debate this issue and say every single holiday we celebrate, they're man-made holidays, every single one.
Yeah, they are. But one needs to understand, but you know, what we've done as a creative people is always take on just whatever practice is going down and made this just a day of where a family gathering, where you get to interact with your family, but not also recognize that most thoughts come out of one human to another. The divinity process, we would have to have a better debate about that, a more open debate about that. But all holidays are created by man.
Brother Nukim Nyerere, right. Thank you very much for being with us. And
okay.
State with us the name of your...
My name is Bokim Nyerere. I'm from the New York chapter, the National Association of Kiwaida Organizations. The website that would put people mostly into us is www.iaafestival.org. www.iaafestival.org. Email address would be NACO, N-A-K-O. infogroup@yahoo.com.
Habarigani, Habarigani, Kwanzaa. Feel the joy as we sing of the love togetherness can surely bring emotion. Set the table, matter strong, thankful for the first fruits of the year. This day I light a candle just for you. Come join the party, it's a celebration. Karamu at Kwanzaa time of year. Red and yellow, black or white, your old, it's alright. It's a celebration that should last throughout the year.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Alright.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Together there is so much we can do.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Teddy Pendergrass, Happy Kwanzaa. Spiritual jazz legend Pharoah Sanders made his transition on September 24, 2022. He was born on October 13, 1940, in a religious household. His mother worked at an elementary school, and his father was employed by the city. Pharoah Sanders moved to New York in 1962 during the evolution of the free jazz era, reportedly created by saxophonist Ornette Coleman and pianist Cecil Taylor. Sanders joined John Coltrane's band in 1965. After Coltrane transitioned in 1967, Pharoah began playing with Alice Coltrane, a multi-instrumentalist and composer. 2 years later, he recorded Karma on the Impulse label. However, after Coltrane made his transition, he also recorded the album Tahid, a work that centered Pharoah Sanders as a composer and visionary. His classic work, The Creator Has a Master Plan, was revered by jazz fans all over the world. We close this final program of COVID, Race, and Democracy this year with a tribute to one of the iconic composers and musicians in the world, Pharoah Sanders, who was known for his relentless experimentation and research into sound itself. Farrell once said, "I listen to everything. Car horns, the squeaking of a door. I listen to sounds, lightning and thunder." The Farrell Saunders Quartet, the creator has a master plan. Farrell Saunders on tenor saxophone, William Henderson III on piano, Alex Blake on bass, and Hammett Drake on drums. Recorded live in Germany, October 19, 1999. Farrell Saunders left Impulse in 1973 and continued to discover music of various cultural traditions. He found stability with an independent label, Teresa, in 1987, which was sold to Evidence in 1991. Saunders traveled to Africa for a State Department cultural exchange program during the 90s. Verb Records released Message from Home in 1995 and later Save Our Children in 1998. In 2000, Saunders released Spirits. In 2003, a live album entitled The Creator Has a Master Plan. Farrell Saunders lived in the Bay Area and continued to compose music, including ballets, and toured throughout Europe and the United States. He received the 2016 Jazz Masters Award from the National Endowment for the Arts. In March 2021, he released a new album, Promises, that was a collaboration with the London Symphony Orchestra. Farrell Saunders made his transition in Los Angeles, California on September 24th, 2022. This is Farrell Saunders, You've Got to Have Freedom, a political and artistic composition released in 2004. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt of KPFT and co-produced by Fahima Sek of WPFW. I'm also an executive producer of CRD, along with Paulina Vasiliev and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. Our resistance gave us an identity. Our identity gave us strength. Our strength gave us an unbreakable will. Albert Woodfox, from his memoir, Solitary, Unbroken by Four Decades in Solitary Confinement.